Well, thank you, Mr. Oliver. As you know, tomorrow is the day that Christians around the world celebrate Easter. I was noticing as I was walking up the stairs, there's a little card on the picture. If you've noticed on the stairway, it says it's not about the bunny. Obviously, an attempt by somebody to try to redirect what the day is about. For us, though, Passover is still nearly a month away, and as we plan for and think about the coming spring holy days, I was thinking about what kind of a message that I would come up with. A lot of times we will look at different topics to illuminate something that maybe, you know, that we didn't know, or a different aspect about something that might be forgotten or not highlighted very often. And sometimes we focus on weaknesses that we might have as a person, individually, or even as a congregation. But today I'd rather focus on a different angle as we approach the coming holy days. I'd like to look at the strengths that we have, not just individually, but as a congregation. The strengths that we have here that God uses to do His work in all of us. For a title today, the title is God's Work in All of Us. And it hit me that there's two ways of trying to get through a trial. One way is you look at the weaknesses that we have, and we say, okay, if I didn't have these weaknesses, God could really work through me. On the other hand, if you're trying to get through a problem, the first thing you do is you go and you look at what strengths you have. And the strengths that you have will bring you by a problem in many ways more effectively than focusing on the weaknesses. So you might think, well, what do we have that makes us so strong or makes us worthy of having these things mentioned here? Today, I'd like to talk about some of these strengths that we have learned as part of this congregation that will help us overcome the trials ahead. You know, recently, Mr. Walker talked about putting on the whole armor of God. And as I listened to those, I thought about the fact that most of the items mentioned were defensive in nature. You know, when you're preparing for battle and you start putting all those items on, they're all generally designed for defense. You have a helmet, you've got a breastplate, you've got a shield, and those are designed to protect you, to deflect blows, and to protect you from the onslaught of your enemy. But there is a sword that is mentioned, the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. And this can be an offensive weapon as much as it can be a defensive weapon. Many of you have heard the phrase, a good offense is the best defense. Because if all we do is shore up our defenses all the time, then we're not ready to move forward. We're not ready to take on the enemy and to move forward. When I think of armor and being a soldier for God, a story that comes to mind is the story of David and Goliath. Why don't you turn over to 1 Samuel 17? The story of David and Goliath is sort of like those stories, like the story of Jonah. It's one of these stories we teach our children. And sometimes it rarely gets covered at the pulpit because it's one of these ones that we all know, we can all recite, we all know the basic tenets of what happened. But as we learned a number of weeks ago, in the story of Jonah, there are things there that we can pull that are things that we might already know, but we might not have looked at in the same way. 1 Samuel 17, we'll pick up the story here in verse 3. So the Philistines and Israelites faced each other on opposite hills with the valley between them. You can see the picture here. You've seen it in movies where the two opposing forces face each other across this big valley. And in verse 4, then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was a giant of a man, measuring over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet and a coat of mail that weighed 125 pounds. You know, what is the ceiling in here? Is it 8 or 9 feet? So the ceiling in here is 8 feet, and so he was 9 feet, over 9 feet. Back when I looked at the translation, it was somewhere around between 9 and 9.5 feet. So he was taller than this room. And so you get a picture when you think of David. He was just a boy at the time, and how he looked. He was obviously lighter than Goliath's armor was. And so as the story progresses, we see that David in the story is sent back and forth between the army and his home. David had three older brothers that were serving in the army at the time, and his father Jesse had sent David up to the front to bring some food and supplies to his brothers and to bring word back on how things were going. And during this confrontation that went on for many, many days, in fact, it went on for 40 days at the time that David really enters the story, where Goliath, in the morning and then again in the evening, would walk out from his ranks, stand out into that valley, and shout out at Israel, "Is there any man among you who is strong enough to come and face me? We can end this right now. There's no reason to have a big war. We can settle this just one single battle. Winner take all." And he did this day and night for 40 days. And as David was working his way around the camp, doing the duties that he was came to do, some of the people in the Israelite camp were talking about trying to go up against this giant. And they were mentioning how the king, King Saul, had promised this giant bounty for anyone who could stand up and defeat Goliath. He was going to give him his daughter. He was going to make his family exempt from taxes for the rest of their life. And David started getting intrigued by this. And so he started inquiring, what's all this about a bounty? What do we have to do for this? This doesn't seem so bad. And meanwhile, Goliath is out there spouting as he does, and he really started to get David upset. And David was saying, who is this guy to be challenging the armies of the living God? Who does he think he is anyway? His brothers found out that he was talking like this, and they tried to shut him down in a hurry. You don't know what you're talking about. You need to hush. You need to go back to the farm. Go take care of the sheep. You're in no shape to do anything about this. Just keep your mouth shut. But he kept up with it. And he kept up with it because he was persistent. And he kept saying, I think I could take this guy out. Nobody can stand against the living God the way he is. Somebody's got to take care of him. Well, the word got back to King Saul that there was actually somebody in the camp who was willing to stand up to this guy. And he definitely wanted to meet this guy, so he had David brought before him. And David told the king he could take care of Goliath. But when King Saul saw how old David was, he said in verse 33, "Don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There is no way you can go against this Philistine. You are only a boy, and he has been in the army since he was a boy." But David persisted. "I have been taking care of my father's sheep," he said. Well, that makes me qualified. "And when a lion or bear comes to steal the lamb from the flock, I go after him with a club and take the lamb out of its mouth. If an animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death. I have done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it again to this pagan Philistine, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who saved me from the claws of the lion and the bear will save me from this Philistine." Well, Saul began to see David's way. He began to become inspired by David's persistence. David had great faith that things were going to be all right, and his faith was catching to Saul. And so Saul says, "All right, go ahead, and may the Lord be with you." Now, usually here we focus on David facing Goliath with only a slingshot and taking him out with one throw. But you know, there's a little more to the story. You see, Saul first offers David his armor and his sword, his own personal armor. And what does David do? He tries it on. Even though David had great faith, the thought of having some extra insurance was a pretty comforting thought. So he tries on the armor, and in verse 39, he puts it on, strapped on the sword over it. He took a few steps to see what it was like, for he had never worn such things before. So even though David believed God would protect him, this didn't seem like a bad idea, having some extra armor and a sword. Problem was, he didn't know how to fight with a sword, and the armor was heavy. David's principal weapon was the sling. And trying to throw a sling or to use a club or the staff when he had all this armor on was really difficult. So, he says, Continuing on, "I can't go in these," he protested. "I'm not used to them." So he took them off again. And in verse 40, he picked up 5 smooth stones from a stream and put them into a shepherd's bag. Then, armed only with a shepherd's staff and a sling, he started out across to fight Goliath. One other interesting part about this story is when Goliath laughed at David when he approached, David ran up to meet Goliath. He wasn't intimidated by him. You know, David didn't rely on one stone. He didn't go and say, "I'm going to use a slingshot. Here's my rock. Where's he at?" He took 5 stones. Yet God blessed the first stone. The lesson here is that we have to do all that we can, even though we know that we can't do it by ourselves. David knew that he could not beat Goliath without God's protection. But he certainly wasn't waiting for God to take Goliath out himself. David had to do the work. Like David, we have assets at our disposal. Like David, we have more than one stone to throw that God can work with. It requires effort. David had to physically bend over and pick up the stones. He had to face the enemy. He had to fling the stone with all of his strength because the stones weren't going to fling themselves through the air. Also, David chose a weapon that he was good at using. You know, anyone in that day would have said, "You're going against him with what? I mean, use a sword. That's how people fight battles." It was an unusual weapon, and it was an unlikely pair that have such a small person with such a silly weapon in the eyes of a soldier could face a foe as formidable as Goliath. You know, he couldn't go after Goliath with a defense, but with an offense. And he couldn't use the method that the king had thought to use because he wasn't used to using them. This is why I want to focus on our strengths that we have now instead of our weaknesses. Because David did eventually learn how to use a sword. He did eventually have his own armor. And he did eventually fight like all the other soldiers did. But at the time he needed to fight that battle, he had to go to battle with the skills that he had. Our future here with the Holy Days is coming fast approaching us. We have to use the talents and abilities we have now to get us through the trials ahead. Everybody knows there are pre-feast trials that befall us. Sometimes it's just stress. And that's all it is stress, trying to get everything done. And sometimes it's much worse than that. And we have to use the strengths that we have to get us through those. So let's talk about the strengths that we have and the things that we have learned and put into practice right here in this congregation. You know, in Matthew 16:18, it says, "And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." The church and this congregation, as being part of that church, has such a powerful role to play in the plan of God being worked out here on earth. God works through us as individuals, yes, and he works through us as a congregation. And he's doing a very powerful work that will outlast death itself. You know, we have strengths that we have here on earth that God can use. And they might not seem like all that wonderful on the surface. We might not think of them as spiritual weapons at all. But they are effective at tearing down the systems that Satan has built. Spiritual weapons that God can cut through the misinformation that Satan broadcasts. And we have grown to use our strengths to protect and strengthen one another. Some of these strengths may not seem at all like strengths at all, but strengths move us forward. And for this reason, they are offensive and not defensive. You know, I've attended a lot of congregations in my 30-plus years of being in the church, as I'm sure many of you have. And over that time, I've been in big churches, the biggest one being in Big Sandy, where every week we had over 1,500 people. It was like having a feast every week. Smallest congregation I've ever been to was right here in Bend. When I came to Bend in about 10 years ago, 1998, there was about a dozen people here, give or take. And every congregation I've ever been to has strengths. Every church has characteristics that God can use to do His will. But as I look back over the 10 years that I've been here, I begin to really start to marvel at the growth that we've had here. For a while, growth to us was just about numbers. We talk about, boy, we sure like to have more people. And that was the thing that we talked about every week. Sure be nice to have more people. But as we begin to grow spiritually and grow with one another, the growth inside of us is so much more important than the number of us. I remember being back in the Environmental Center in 1998. How many were here then? Few people here. And we used to meet in this small community center in Bend where in the morning Wiccans would meet. And they would burn their incenses and dance around the floor. And when we'd go in there, we'd open the windows up to get the smell of the incense and anything else that wanted to leave. So we feel comfortable having services in there. And then we really came up in the world. We moved to the basement of the SDA hall, where we met in a little Sabbath school classroom. We didn't have a sound system. That was Mr. Walker. He'd walk up to the front of the room, and he had a little tape recorder, and he'd push the play and record at the same time. It was one of those older ones. And he'd start talking. And when the tape would stop, he'd have to take the tape out and turn it over and start record again, and he'd start talking again. That was our sound system. Most of the time we're Bible study format, so we didn't have a song service. And church services was roughly about 90 minutes long. We, at one point, moved upstairs to the sanctuary upstairs in the SDA hall, and that room was so big. And when we did get to do song service, I really didn't like that job. Because when you're standing up there, and there was 18 people in this room that would hold 150, and when people would sing, the sound would disappear. You felt like you were doing a solo. And all you could hear from the pulpit was your voice. And the sound just would disappear. Once in a while, we'd go to another hall with a lower ceiling, and you could actually hear people sing. It was really amazing. But the numbers grew. But, you know, even back in the Seventh-day Adventist hall, there was something I remember that I see a vast difference between then and now, and which brings us to our first strength that we have as a congregation. We have learned to slow down and focus on what is important. Now, that may not seem like some big, powerful weapon, but think back, for those who remember meeting in the Seventh-day Adventist hall, church was at 1:30. Most people arrived around 1:25. It's just what we did. We arrived around 1:25. Church would start about 1:30. And church would be over an hour and a half later, and within 20 minutes, most of the people had left. And it's not that we weren't friendly. It's not that we didn't care about one another. We just didn't have strong bonds. We didn't know each other as well then. For us, our entire religious experience was about 95 minutes in length. For some, maybe two whole hours that we'd be together each week. But look at us now. We were marveling last week that we were leaving about 6 p.m. from the hall here. On average, we're here about 5 hours. We get here early. We stay late every week. And we fellowship. And it's like we can't get enough of each other's company. We get together during the week more often than we ever have. Lisa talked to me about when she was up at the women's seminar. Some of you went here, as you know. And for those that weren't there, a little story that I'll pass along. She had to give a speech, and because the topic of the speech was living in a remote area and what it's like to be in the church in a remote area, Lisa came up to the lectern in her mountain gear with her winter coat and scarf and big rubber boots. As everyone else was in their church attire, she came up and gave them a kind of a flavor of what it was like to come out from a remote area. Because when we go to the valley for like Northwest Weekend, we come in there in our grubby clothes from traveling. and everyone's in their nice clothes. They showed up at the hall in their nice clothes, and we come in our grubby clothes because we've been traveling. And we might have had to put chains on, or we might have had to, get out in the snow for bathroom breaks or whatever. So we have to change at the hall. So she was given a little bit of flavor of what it's like to live in a remote area. But then she talked about how warm it is to be here each and every week. And she mentioned that we all have our coffee mugs on the wall. And this big aw came out from the audience. It is a wonderful thing that we have each week where we can be together and we can fellowship and we can strengthen one another. It is our family as much as our own family is. You know, sometimes the conversation is too familiar. But you know, as families go, we have to learn how to strengthen one another. It's something that happens over time. And as we become more and more familiar with each other's needs, and we start to meet those needs, we start finding ways to open up and to talk about those spiritual topics, to talk about the trials that we're going through. We begin to know what it's like to walk in each other's shoes because we really get to know one another. When we spend time in each other's homes, we stay late, don't we? You know, Lisa and I were talking about when we first got married after college, we both lived in church areas where when you had somebody over, you usually stayed late. And we decided we were going to start to have some people over now that we were married, and we could have people over every week if we wanted. The first thing we noticed is it was really hard to get somebody to come over to your house. Generally, in the church area, they like to meet at a restaurant or something like that. And the whole meeting would last about however long the meal took. So when we finally did get somebody to come over to our house, the first thing they said is, well, when should we come over? We said, just after church. And they said, well, what time? We said, after church. He said, well, we'll go home and change. I said, well, you could bring your clothes and change at our place. And it was like you were invading their privacy. And they said, well, what if we come over like 7 o'clock? And it was okay. So they come over at 7, and by 9 o'clock, they'd be gone again because they didn't want to impose. It took a long time for people to start to warm up to that. We don't have that problem here. You know, when we go to each other's houses, it's pushing 10, 11 o'clock, and it's, oh, maybe we should go home before tomorrow comes. So we have learned to slow down. You know, one of my favorite shows is the Andy Griffith Show. And it's on TV again. And there was this one episode. I love this episode. It's about a businessman who comes into town and his car breaks down, and it's on a Sunday. And so he has to walk himself into town from the outskirts, and he sees the filling station. There's nobody there. And so he walks down to Main Street, and there's nobody there. And he's trying to figure out, where's everybody in this town? And then he hears a church bell ring. So he follows the sound of the bell, and here's everybody coming out of church. So he goes over there to see if he can find somebody to help him get his car going, because he's on his way to Charlotte, and he's late. Well, nobody wants to work on his car, because it's Sunday, and they're taking the day off. But he persists, and I'm in a big, big hurry. So a few people go to try to help him, but the sheriff invites him over to the house and said, why don't you just take a load off? And he's just impatient. He's got to be somewhere. He's got important things to do. It took the entire show for him to realize that what the town had was something really special. They had a pace about them that allowed them to enjoy all of the richness that life had to offer. And by the end of the show, he decided to stay on overnight. It is really a wonderful thing when you can slow down, look at what's important, and start to focus on some of the things that are truly meaningful and edifying to one another. And the reason we're able to do that is because of number two. We are learning the true meaning of congregation. You know, Hebrews 10, if you want to turn over there, Hebrews 10, it's one of the scriptures that get read when we start talking about congregation. Hebrews 10 and verse 24. And it says, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, It starts off by saying, when we consider each other, we are stirring up love and good works. And in verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. As we have grown in our own relationships with God, we have realized the importance of having one another for support. The closer we get to God, the more we know it's important to not go it alone. We have taken the time to learn about each other's needs. We pray for one another. I mean, I've never been in a congregation where people could just so openly come up here and speak to everyone about, I'm having these issues, can you please pray for me? I love that openness that we have and that ability to share. We desire to spend time together. When someone is gone, they are sorely missed. Are we perfect in this area? No. Sometimes we don't call people when they haven't been here for a week or more as often as we should. But when they're back, we sure miss them. And we hear people say, boy, I've been gone for a few weeks. I sure miss this place. I sure miss everybody here. You know, you look at the participation in services we get each week. Everybody knows about our snacks. Every time somebody comes here, oh, that's right, you guys have snacks every week. And having snacks every week might not seem like a very wonderful, godly, mission-oriented thing at all. But think about how God views food. When God met with Abraham, it was over a meal. The Passover's coming up. That was over a meal. When Christ returns, there's going to be a wedding supper over a meal. All the feast days are designed around meals. Having food is as much a part about being in a congregation with God as the service itself. And we participate in it wholeheartedly. I look forward to it each week. We all talk about how we don't need to have dinner Saturday night. If we do anything, it's snacks-oriented at home because there's so much food here. And even if you only partake in the coffee, Terry, we're still all a part of that process. You know, think about the people that are involved in setting up the hall each week, the people that are involved in cleaning up after snacks each week. You know, we fill out cards here on the back table. I haven't been in a church area where people pass the cards around after church and everybody makes sure that they get them signed. It's really a wonderful thing that so many cards get sent out with so many people writing in them. Most churches I've been to, if they had a card program, it was on a table somewhere, and a few people might remember to go out and fill out a card. But having this program here where we pass these cards around is a wonderful thing that we're doing for other people. You know, we serve at the feast and the information booth. We have a wonderful children's education program here. And participation services itself, from song leading and accompaniment to special music, working on the sound system, and even with prayers. Is there anybody here that doesn't fit one of these categories? At least one. And I believe by next year, it'll even be more participation, not less. You know, Proverbs 27:17 says, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends. Congregation is what brings people, not just together, but brings people in a place that God can really begin to work with them in ways that he could not work with them alone. Number three, we participate in service projects. Could we do more? Sure. But you know, as I think about some of the church areas I've been to, for such a small group, we've done way more per capita than most all the other church areas I've ever been to. You know, I remember back when we all started helping some of the people from Hurricane Katrina. If you remember those days, there was a family that came here from New Orleans. They weren't in the church, but they needed help. And some of the people here. It wasn't an idea that came from the pulpit. It was an idea that came from within. We should do something about this. And everybody pitched in. They donated their time, their money, whatever there was of it, time, excess, items, to that effort. So the people that came here had their basic needs met. And they were very appreciative of us. Turn over to Matthew 25. Matthew 25, and starting in verse 36. This is a passage we've read many times. Again, I'm not trying to bring up any new truths here, but just to remind us of things that we already know. It's a passage very familiar. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you cared for me. I was in prison and you visited me. And then the righteous ones will reply, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink, or strangers and show you hospitality, or naked and give you clothing? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king said, the king will tell them, assuredly, I say unto you, when you did it to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were doing it to me. You know, there are so many opportunities to help, not just people in the community, but one another. And it is really kind of inspiring when we see some of these calls for help to come from within the body and not from the pulpit, because it's showing that everyone really is getting this. I think back to the Young Adults Weekend. The Kesters were very persistent in bringing it up, like David. And at first I thought, Young Adults Weekend, you know, we don't have that many young adults here. But they were persistent, and it was a very big success. The road cleanup, to see the mess that was cleaned up by that, was just tremendous. And the fellowship that we got to have with all those people from the valley, because we are disconnected, and it allows us, through a simple service project, we were allowed to get connected with a lot of our brethren that we might only see it Holy Days each year. It was a wonderful event. Think about the Peruvian brethren. We saw the video today. I was feeling really good about our 5 hours here each week until they said, oh no, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. For those people, that's a marathon. But we've helped a number of them attend the feast each year, which is such a small group. I mean, there's 450 Peruvians, as you heard, and there's just a small number of us. And yet we've made an impact on a number of them being able to attend the feast. You know, we have a yard sale every year. We recycle our print cartridges. We even have a penny jar. I mean, it's just the widow's mite is what it is what we are. But it does a tremendous thing to help people attend the Feast of Tabernacles. Every year we think we won't be able to help much this year because we gave everything away last year, but we always seem to find things to throw into the pile and to contribute. And we're always amazed by how much money is collected each and every year. So there's always opportunities for service, and it is a powerful tool that God has to affect not only our own lives, but to affect the lives of others. Number four, we've all learned lessons of faith from our own trials and from one another. What a powerful tool this is. To take a trial or a lesson that you've learned and to keep somebody else from going down the same path you did. To help somebody to avoid some horrible predicament because they learned from something that we have already gone through. It is a wonderful thing when we can strengthen one another. Turn over to Luke 22. Here is the passage that is very apropos to read this time of year. It's talking about the time right before Jesus was arrested. He's talking with Simon right before, and he's just about to tell him that he's going to deny him three times. But before he said that, he said this, and the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan will ask for you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. It must be amazing to have God tell you that he's praying for you. And then, when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. When you've gone through a trial, and you've gotten through it, strengthen one another. 1 John 1:7 gets read at Passover time. And it says, but if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Jesus Christ, his son, cleanses us from all sin. When Jesus prayed for his disciples, he talked about the Helper, the Holy Spirit that was going to come, that was going to allow them to be one with God. Now, if you're one with God and your congregation is one with God, then you are one with your congregation. 1 Peter 4 and verse 8 says, verse 8 through 10 says, and above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will conquer or cover a multitude of sins. This is one I'm really grateful for, because I suffer from foot and mouth disease all the time. Love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. We are always passing things that we have that are extra on to one another as we see needs. It's just an amazing thing. Sometimes it's a lesson. Sometimes it's encouragement. And sometimes it's something that somebody might need. But when we have a gift that God has given us, he says, minister to one another and just share it. And it is a wonderful thing to have a place where that takes place. The fifth and last one I want to cover today, I call All I Need to Know I Learned in Sabbath School. You know, we have learned many things over the years that we take for granted sometimes. That's why I covered the topic of Jonah, talked a little bit about David and Goliath, children's stories, lessons that we teach our children that there's so much more that we can learn as adults. I took this point based upon the book All I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. In that book, we see the lessons that children learn can prepare them to handle adult-sized problems. Some of the examples from that is to be polite and kind with one another. They teach that to kindergartners, but somehow people forget that when they get older. Talk out your problems and don't bottle them up. That's another thing we teach children, but then as adults we forget. And one of my favorites, a timeout is the best way to handle a bad attitude. How many times do we as adults need a timeout? Or maybe even a good nap? You know, I don't know if any of you remember the movie Karate Kid. Yeah, you remember it. In the movie, a Japanese man named Mr. Miyagi would teach this boy, Daniel, how to use karate to protect himself because he was being harassed and beaten up at school. And he had one condition. I teach, you listen, no questions. And that was one of the most interesting parts about the movie, because as he began to teach him karate, the first thing he said was, paint the fence. And he thought, where's the karate? He says, no questions. So he taught him how to paint the fence. And the next day comes, and he says, paint the house. But what about no questions? Paint the house. And then it was the next day, sand the floors. And he would show him how he's supposed to sand the floors and how he's supposed to paint the fence and how he's supposed to paint the house. The third day, there was just a note. It said, wax the cars. And there was all these cars to wax. Remember the line, wax on, wax off. And he had to put the wax on with one hand and take the wax off with the other. By the end of that day, Daniel was furious. He had just been ripped off. All he did was all of this guy's work, and he hasn't learned anything. And when he got back that night, he showed him he already knew karate. He learned it over the last 4 days. He just didn't know it yet. And that's when he showed him that all of those moves that he was doing was already the things that he needed to know to be successful in karate. You know, spiritual knowledge can work the same way. We're going to use three examples here of spiritual knowledge that we all know. And then I'm going to show you how important those are to really, really understand. The first spiritual principle that we all know is God's love is unconditional. God's love is unconditional. We know this. As a parent, when do we stop loving our children? How many times do they make a mistake and we said, okay, we don't love you anymore? It never happens. We always love our children, and God will always love us. Number two, we can pray even when we don't feel worthy. We know that. Sometimes it's really hard to pray when you don't feel worthy, isn't it? We can pray when we don't feel worthy. And the third one, God will never give us a trial bigger than we can handle. That's a tough one. Because some people are tried unto death. How they're able to handle that, God only knows. But these are three things that we all know. But yet, it is so hard to put these into practice, isn't it? You know, I'd like to play a video that speaks about these three aspects. Lisa first showed it to me, and when she saw it to me, I was pretty busy doing something else. She says, oh, you need to come and see this. So she turned it on, and I'm looking at it. And I think to myself, this isn't something that I want to waste my time on. It didn't look that interesting. And so I was giving it lip service, say, okay. Yeah. And she said, no, it's really, really good. And so she just advanced it. It's about 6 minutes long to where it really got interesting. And I was blown away by it. You know, it starts off with two characters. One is playing the part of God. It's a one-act play. One is playing the part of God, and the other person is a woman who is called by God. In the play, God calls her, and she begins to respond to him. He begins to teach her his ways. She begins to learn how to become a mirror image of God. And as they build their relationship, he begins to show her all of his wonders. And like happens to so many people, she gets distracted and starts going down the wrong path. At this point, other characters are introduced in the play that represent all of Satan's devices that on the surface don't seem that bad, but when you get to know them, you realize how destructive they are. And they leave her empty and confused. One by one, these characters begin to draw her away from God. These other characters represent improper love, greed, vanity, all leading to a character that represents destructive behavior to the point where the girl wants to end her life. I would like the attention of all the children here. This video is kind of like a play. It's like kind of like play acting. The play was performed at a concert. It was a Christian concert. It was performed up on a stage in front of a lot of people. And the play has some scenes that might seem scary, but it is addressing some things that are very serious problems in life, and some people really go through these things sometimes. The important thing to know is that this video here is to teach us about God, and it has a happy ending. And it is only a play, and people are only acting. But the play illustrates God's commitment to us and his love for us, even though our life, at times, seems to be spiraling out of control. When things go terribly bad for her, keep a watch on what God is doing. Does he turn his back? Does he leave her in her sin? Does he give up on her? See if, while all the action is going on, if you can keep an eye on God as you watch. We'll play the video now. You are the Gets me every time I watch it. You know, the video says so much visually. When she begins to become distracted, did you watch God? He does not give up on her. When her life spirals out of control, did you watch God? He tries to get her attention. You know, we think we're not very close to God right now, so he probably has his back to us. But we know that God's love is unconditional. And if we know that God's love is unconditional, he wouldn't be turning his back on us. He'd be trying to get our attention, just as he did. He does not look the other way, but remains actively involved trying to bring her back. As she tries to return to God, do you see how difficult it was to break free from Satan's devices? And what was God doing? Waiting for her to get completely straightened out before he was going to intervene? No, the entire time he was pulling her to him. And when the trial began to be too much for her to bear, he stepped in and he protected her until she was able to surrender her will to God, and then all of her demons were vanquished, and she was free once again. And what penalties did she have to pay for this time away from God? Their life picked up right where it left off, didn't it? You know, each time I watch it, I appreciate God more and more. God's unconditional love is something we give lip service to, but do we really focus on the fact that unconditional love means God loves us no matter how far we drift or get pulled away from him? No matter how unworthy we may feel about ourselves as and far from God, he loves us and he wants us back. You know, as we look ahead to the spring holiday season, that God's love is presented to us and exemplified by the Passover, let's remember that God's love is unconditional, that we can pray when we don't feel worthy. And as a congregation, we have learned the skills that we can use to support and serve one another to do a powerful work here on earth, that God's work will be done through us on this earth.